Welcome to Old Money, a show dedicated to helping you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. Ladies who lunch, listen up. Life is not about looking rich. I want you to build a life and a legacy that feels rich in every sense of the word. If you're ready to stack cash, talk shop, and trade insider secrets, you're in the right place. These are the new rules to old money. So let's get after it. What is up, rich girls? Welcome back to Old Money, the podcast to help you build the trust fund you wish you were born with. I am your host, Amber Frankhusen. How y'all doing? So happy to have you back for part two of the Bravo Brain Dump. I have gotten so much feedback on the first episode, and we're going back there again. Now, I know not all of you are Bravo fans. I'm not here to alienate you at all whatsoever. So I apologize, but I am the type of person that likes to rot their brain on a regular basis with a little bit of reality TV. Today's episode, though, I didn't even get to all the good stuff. We didn't even get to really talk about the financial stuff, all of the lessons learned. This is finance for Bravo fans. So whether you are a fan of the Summer House, the Below Deck, the Housewives, the Vanderpump Rules, if you are, if you aren't, there's something for everyone in this episode. And speaking of episodes, last episode sparked a lot of conversation that I want to share with you. As I mentioned, I got so much great feedback, and I love that you guys loved it, for those of you who are Bravo fans. And I want to shout out a couple of our listeners. So on social media, I made a couple of roundups of the highlights of the most wealthy housewives, and then also what people are making per episode on the show. And I got such a good message from somebody named Danielle Hitt, who messaged me. And she said, what about Heather and Terry Dubrow from OC? They must have more money than Nene, no? And Nicole Martin from Miami and her fiance sold their house in Miami to Jeff Bezos, actually to his mother, for $44 million and originally bought it for $13 million. That's major. I think those online net worth sites are highly inaccurate. They say Dr. Nicole is only worth $3 million, but I think it's more, especially if her name was on the house. I love this. Danielle, first of all, Heather Dubrow should 1,000% be on this list. And I didn't just go through lists on social media. I literally went through every single franchise. I went through Potomac and Salt Lake City and even Dallas and Miami. I totally forgot about Dr. Nicole. That was an oversight. However, she's not married yet to the insurance guy. So they are engaged, which is totally, you know, heading in the right direction. They have two kids together, but they're not legally married yet. And she's an anesthesiologist, so I'm sure she does very well for herself, but that $3 million net worth actually might be accurate. However, I'm going to tell you the honest to God truth. I literally did not even think about Orange County, not because I thought anything negative about them. I literally just blocked it out of my head. I didn't even consider them. I didn't even go through. Because if we're talking about Nene at a $15 million net worth, I would hazard a guess that Vicky's around somewhere in that same region. And Shannon Bedore actually comes from old money as well. As we know from her struggles with her divorce, she's probably not benefiting from that just yet. But that was a really, really good call out. So thank you, Danielle. And then the other thing that I wanted to say, that was such an oversight. I was listening back and I was talking about the Vanderpump Rules stars' salaries and how they got so high because they were all on the show for so long. Well, that is one of the reasons why they rumor that that show was not renewed, because they have to pay Shishu, Sheena, and Lala, and James Kennedy, and Tom Sandoval, and Ariana so much money, all of them, because they're an ensemble cast, that it was just becoming too expensive of a show to produce. That's going to come up later in our conversations, and we talk about index funds. I have a great analogy for you, but it's also rumored to be one of the reasons why they did not renew Real Housewives of New York with Luann and Dorinda and Sonia and Ramona. They had been on the show for so long and had so much tenure there that they were making very high salaries per season, per episode. And that is one of the reasons why, as a business decision, you don't see these shows renew, because they just cost too much to make, versus a Southern Hospitality, which is apparently, I've heard from you guys, I need to watch it. I heard it's popping off. People are furious that the season is not as many episodes as they expected. They're loving the show. They're saying it's an absolute train wreck. So on a weekend where I have some downtime, that will be one I tune into. But those kids are not making any money. So for the network, it's super, super profitable, which is so interesting. Same thing with a show like Watch What Happens Live, right? That gets a ton of viewership, it gets a ton of press, but it actually doesn't cost a ton of money to make. And another thing that came up from social media that made me giggle, which is such a good point, when I did the post that had the roundups of what all of those junior level casts are making per episode, the last slide, and some of you caught it, I got a few DMs, the last slide that I put in there was Real Girlfriends of Paris. And it's a couple of girls on my team. And I also got some DMs that were like, what the fuck is that? Like, I've never even heard of that show. And let me tell you something, people. You are sleeping on that show. It's called Real Girlfriends of Paris. It's about these 20-something girls that live in Paris. It was only one season. I was robbed of a second season. And it is just good old-fashioned girlies being girlies, living their best life. They're all expats from America and Canada trying to find their way in the city of love. Some are dating. They're having careers. One's a fashion designer. One's trying to convince her boyfriend, who's French, to get her pregnant, and she's giving tours at a museum. It's just such good, clean fun. I highly recommend it if you need some girl time in your life. And the other show that I recommended, so this came up in our team meeting on Monday. So yes, if you work for AF Marketing, these are some of the topics we discuss. But there's a show that you can still watch. It's an OG show called NYC Prep. If you guys have watched it and you loved it like I did, please send me a DM so we can discuss it, because I just watched it maybe a year ago, and then you go on this deep dive to see where they all are now. It was filmed, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, and it's about these real life Gossip Girl characters, all these prep school kids that live in New York and are acting like young adults and how ridiculous they are. And they're so immature, thinking they're mature. It's such a good watch. It's on Peacock if you want to watch it. So, so good. And there's another ridiculous Bravo show that was called Dance Queens, another just one season wonder. Absolutely ridiculous middle-aged women who compete in ballroom dancing, and you see all of the drama and the hairstyles and the fashion and the professional dancers going against the amateurs. I watched it with my friend Susanna last year, and we laughed so hard at the ridiculousness of it all. It's like a bunch of Karens dancing around. Absolutely phenomenal stuff. So those are some of my recommendations if you are needing to fill your content plate. However, I don't know how you would be, because there's so much good TV on right now. And another topic that came up was about Southern Charm and Shep. And one of the things that I didn't mention on last week's show that I think is worth discussing, Shep Rose, who is currently the cringiest person on our televisions with his long messages to his girlfriend, Sienna. If you're not caught up on that show, I highly recommend it. We are seeing a lovesick Shep, and it's heartbreaking to watch, but it's also highly entertaining. So he comes from a long line of very wealthy people. He is absolutely silver spooned, mailbox money, trust fund baby. And so people asked, and like somebody messaged me about this, like, why is he on the show? He doesn't really need the paycheck. Like, if you talk about Southern Charm and you're looking at how much they make per episode, per season, you know, 25 grand an episode, he's making a pretty penny, but does he need it? Like, why does he continue to do it? And one of the reasons why we see a lot of really wealthy people go on television is because money can buy you a lot of things, but one of the things it cannot buy you is fame. The desire to be famous, to be seen, to be admired, to be appreciated, it's a very, very dangerous game to play. And we see a lot of people, especially in these reality TV situations, who are looking for that visibility, and they want to be appreciated and seen. They don't feel fulfilled with what they've accomplished or what they've inherited. And they have this identity crisis where they need to look outside of themselves for validation. That, to me, seems like what's happening with Shep, fully, 100%. Same thing with like a Patricia Altishaw, right? Like, they're craving this outside validation and attention, because at the end of the day, wouldn't you think that Miss Patricia would just like to sit in her house and have her parties and, you know, stay out of the drama? No, she wants to be in it. She wants to be seen. She wants to be positioned. This is all a positioning, a marketing, a gameplay, right? So one of the things that I'm always very cautious about is when, because I believe being wealthy, like, the ultimate privilege is being private. My God, like, I don't want anybody to know what I'm doing ever, honestly. And even as like I've grown in my, I don't want to even say in my wealth because it's not even what it's related to, but as I've grown in my life and found wealth in other ways, I'm so private about what I share. Like I mean, I share a lot with you guys on the show, but there's so much going on and some of it will be revealed coming up here very soon. But my goodness, there's so much that goes on behind the scenes, and the privacy, the things that I do keep very close to the vest are the things that are the most sacred to me that I will protect at all costs. So very interesting dynamics to watch. And then the last thing that I wanted to bring up from last week's episode, and then we'll move on to the new stuff, is one of the things that was so interesting about Vanderpump Rules last season with the Scandoval is that there was so much jealousy around Ariana being so successful coming out of Vanderpump Rules. She was a woman scorned and the world rallied around her, whether it was from just the support that she got on social media or the brand deal she secured with Duracell batteries or her hosting gig on Love Island. She did very well and she came out on top for sure. And Lala and Sheena also expressed a lot of envy around her success. Lala even went as far to say, like, I've never seen somebody get cheated on and then be treated like God. And then, of course, Sheena had her sadness around not being asked to be on Dancing with the Stars, and she was so disappointed, and she was a little envious of that. But as we talked about on last week's episode, is that they all benefited from this scandal, especially financially. It was acutely beneficial to their pocketbooks, to their opportunities, to their visibility. And yet they sit there and they still complained that they didn't get as much as somebody else. And that is the type of stuff that seeking of the fame, the looking outside of yourself for validation, the being really envious of people and not honoring the opportunities that come to you or that you've created for yourself in light of circumstances as they play out in your life, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about in cash consciousness. Because whether you have a ton of money or you don't have any at all, who are you? And the more grounded you can get in understanding how you react to money and how money triggers you, all of the things that comes along with new opportunities, seeing your friends win, you having a loss and then getting support in that way, whatever that is, it all comes down to who are you? What do you value? Where are you going? And how can you find wealth in your life at every stage of the game? All's that to say, last week's episode was definitely a fire starter. I love having these conversations with you guys, but let's get into some money. Today's episode is investigating some of the biggest scandals that have ever happened on our televisions, especially on Bravo, and what it has to do with finance. So let's get into it. The first thing that I want to talk about in today's mission is to break down some concepts that can be applicable to our lives and give you real life examples of how they may have gone right or how they may have gone wrong. The first thing that I want to talk about, and this is, get your notepads out, girlies, because this is a good one. This is a term that is really often used in startup culture, in business, in construction, and it's something that we saw play out on Vanderpump Rules. The term that we're discussing today is called burn rate. What is a burn rate? Well, a burn rate is a financial measurement of how quickly a company or a person spends its cash. So really easily, right? If you have $100,000 in the bank and you are going to spend that $100,000 on keeping the lights on in your world, and that's going to last you 10 months, then your burn rate is $10,000 per month, right? It's usually calculated monthly and it's expressed as an amount of cash spent per month. It's also a measure of negative cash flow, meaning expenditures, things that are going out, not things that are coming in. And essentially, it's a way to indicate runway, which is another term that's really important in startup culture. It's how long is our runway? That's a measurement of months, not cash per month. But if I know that I'm going to have a burn rate of $10,000 per month and I have $100,000 in the bank and nothing else coming in, my runway is 10 months, right? So a higher burn rate means a shorter runway. A lower burn rate indicates a stronger cash position. You either are not spending so much or you have enough money in the bank to last you a longer time. And it's a really important metric to know because it helps companies, especially, and investors understand, number one, where their money is going and whether or not they're going to run out of money. Like, think about it. If that $10,000 per month is going towards payroll and that company is not having any other influx of cash through investors or revenue, and you're working for that company and you know they're going to run out of money in 10 months, I'd be looking for another job. So understanding that is really important. And it's also really important for individuals to understand because a lot of us don't even know how much money we spend on our lives on keeping the lights on per month. So I would say, and I say this in cash consciousness, everybody needs to understand what their burn rate is. Like, what is it that you're burning through the cash, right? What is it that you're burning through on a monthly basis? Are you spending $5,000 a month for everything in your life? Are you spending $15,000 per month on everything in your life? And how can you make adjustments so that you can have a longer runway? Now, a lot of people lose sight of this because every month you typically have new money coming in through your paycheck, right? However, this came into play for me when I was leaving my job and I needed to save a significant amount of money so that I could take a freaking break. I was planning on taking a sabbatical for at least 6 months. So what I did in practice was I got my expenses as low as I possibly could. I got a roommate, I sold a lot of stuff, I kept my expenses very low, and then while I was still working that job, I was setting aside a huge amount of money every single month to build up a nest egg so that I could leave that job and take a break, take a sabbatical, and then figure out the next step. So what I had to calculate was, what is my burn rate? And if I save this amount of money, how many months is that going to get me? Like, when is it going to be that I have to get a new job before dipping into my emergency savings? So I saved enough money to hold me over for at least 6 months, if not more, because my expenses were so low at that time. So I calculated, for example, let's just use round numbers. Let's just say I'm trying to save for 6 months of living expenses and I'm spending $5,000 a month on rent and insurance and gas and electricity and my cell phone and coffee and going out to dinner once a week or whatever that was for me at that time. I would have a burn rate of $5,000 per month, meaning that I needed to save $30,000 to carry me through 6 months if I wasn't going to have any other income coming in. You follow? So where do we see this play out on Bravo? Well, I'm so happy you asked because it's one of my most favorite / infuriating stories that I have ever seen on television. And I'm talking about Schwartz and Sandy's. Number one, the worst name for a bar that I have ever, ever heard. So bad. But this was a perfect example of two people who did not understand runway or burn rate whatsoever. So let's walk through the timeline. Tom Schwartz and Tom Sandoval got their building for Schwartz and Sandy's sometimes between April and May of 2021. They didn't open the bar until November 2nd of 2022. So that's a year and a half of time between when they got the building and when they opened. In that period of time, they were not selling drinks, they were not selling food, they were not producing revenue. So every single month that they owned that building for a year and a half, for 18 months or whatever it was, they were burning cash every single month when they had no revenue coming in. No drinks are being sold, but they still have to pay for their rent, their insurance, their electricity. Every time they had a soft opening and they hosted a party, they had to pay for servers to be there. They did not ever consider why it was more urgent to hurry up and open the bar and get it done just so they could have revenue coming in. Because then, how about that? November 2022 is when they opened. And then March of 2023 was when Scandoval broke and his reputation burned the whole thing to the ground. So essentially, they had 3-4 months of good business, and then it all came crumbling down. You risk so much by not acting quickly in business. They took so long to go through that process that in the meantime, Schwartz also got divorced from his wife, Katie Maloney, and he had to continue to pay $6,000 per month towards his mortgage because that was his portion. So let me just break that down for you. Katie and Tom had a $12,000 per month mortgage, And until their divorce was finalized, he was also still responsible, as having been on that mortgage, to be paying. So he had $6,000 in mortgage, $3,500 in rent, plus all of the expenses that needed to be paid for Shorts and Sandy's, which is insane. So Sandoval also was having a hard time coming up with the money because it was stretching out for so long. Their runway was way too long and their burn rate was way too high. And they were both struggling financially. So in order to help out with that financial struggle, Tom Sandoval took out a HELOC, which is a home equity line of credit. It's spelled H-E-L-O-C. It's an acronym. It's something that you hear in the real estate industry quite often. And a HELOC is where you borrow against the equity of your home. You can get equity through appreciation, if you get your home appraised and it's appreciated over time, or the money that you've already paid into your home through your mortgage, and you can take a line of credit to get some of that in cash. Of course, you do have to pay not only interest, but origination fees and all these other fees to do so. And my gosh, this was just so obviously somebody who did not understand the basics of you're still going to spend money every single month, even if you are not quote unquote open. A better way to approach it would have been to reverse engineer. Here's the burn rate of what it's costing us to hold this building and not have revenue every single month. This is how much money we have invested initially, and then we must open within this timeline so that we do not burn through all of our cash and we open to start producing revenue sooner rather than later. But since they didn't have those basics, those fundamentals nailed down, they kept borrowing money, they kept extending the deadline, and they wasted so much time on making decisions that blew the budget, stuff like the art installations or the lighting or the wallpaper or the names of the drinks. They were so focused on the wrong things that this was a complete financial disaster. And at the end of the day, Shorts and Sandy's closed down for good on November 25th, 2024. So they'd only been open for 2 years, which most of those 2 years happened after Sandoval. So you know they weren't making good money. They burned through so much cash. They had no urgency around opening. They both took on debt. They borrowed money from their parents. It was a total, absolute disaster. Now, alternatively, if you look at what Katie and Ariana did with their Something About Her sandwich shop, they actually had a really similar situation, believe it or not. They criticized the Toms a lot for not knowing what to do with their bar, but they actually ran into some pretty similar issues. And that's the thing about entrepreneurship. You cannot have a high horse about anything or an ego about anything ever, because God knows what will get thrown at you as an entrepreneur. And what happened with Something About Her is they ran into some weird permitting issues on the street where they were building their shop. They actually proceeded with, and who knows if they got bad information or they didn't do research, but whatever it was, they proceeded with building out a sidewalk cafe seating area along with an awning. And it turns out they didn't have the proper permitting for it. So the city of West Hollywood came out. They said, you need to rip this all out. We need to review it. Then we need to have you, if you want to build this, submit for a permit. We'll approve it. And then you can rebuild it again. So they had a ton of issues with that. Not to mention, they also had a ton of drama with the chef that they hired, who actually went out from underneath them and got the trademark to Something About Her without disclosing it to them. So this chef basically went and filed for the trademark without them, the two women who started the business, which is so shady. So this is not legal advice, but I would highly recommend making sure you own the trademark for any business that you start. But like I said, they ran into all these issues. So they probably recognize, okay, we have a certain amount of money. What's our burn rate? Because even when they weren't open, they're paying taxes, insurance, they're paying rent, they're paying for these permits, they're paying for construction. There's a limited amount of money that they have, a finite amount of money that they have. So what did they do? They launched merch, and they made hundreds of thousands of dollars. In light of the Sandoval, they had such an incredible conversion rate on their sales that they were able to get even more money to extend their runway before they were able to open. Now they are open. I have a friend that's went. They said the sandwich was fine, whatever. But now they have an operational business with revenue, and they were more mindful of what their burn rate was and what their runway was. So as far as we've heard, we haven't heard them taking out any crazy loans. They seem to be doing well financially from the looks of things. And of course, you never really know, but I mean, we saw all the mess with the Toms. For better or for worse, and for better it was for our entertainment value, for worse it was for their financial situation. But for better or for worse, we saw the entire mess unfold, but we haven't heard anything totally financially crazy from Katie or Ariana. So wishing them all the best. Now, what can we learn from this? You must know your burn rate. You need to know how much money you spend every single month. We talk about this a lot in cash consciousness, but one of the things that I really don't love is this approach of our monthly expenses being called fixed or variable. Because some people say, well, my mortgage is what my mortgage is, or my car payment is what my car payment is. And that is a fixed amount that I have to pay every single month. On the contrary, my friend, I believe that you are in control of every single one of your payments or expenses, and every single one of them is variable, including your car payment or your house payment. It's your responsibility to take absolute total ownership of every decision you've made, whether it was now or it was 6 months ago or 6 years ago, and you bought something that you couldn't afford then, or maybe you can't afford it now. This excuse of it's a fixed expense and that's what I owe, it's just not honest. As we move and grow and develop or lose jobs, get new jobs, have new circumstances, as the economy changes, as we have more kids, as our financial situations change, we have to own the decisions that we've made. And with the new information that we have, make new decisions. So if you've signed a lease for a car, by the way, I just heard that Cadillac Escalades are leasing for like $2,400 a month. That's insane. If you are leasing a Cadillac Escalade for $2,400 a month and you could afford it at the time you signed the lease and then something changed, it's your responsibility to figure out a solution to get out of that contract, to give back the lease, to sell the car, to do the things, to trade it in, to change your situation. If you bought an Escalade and you can't afford it anymore, but you're telling me, but Amber, I'm a car person. That car is, it means so much to me. I love that. Then you are putting your identity into that car and you care so much about your identity. I'm going to tell you, your identity is going to be poor. You want to be a rich girl, right? So you have to make decisions that sometimes look strange to your neighbors, or sometimes you feel embarrassed about, sometimes you have shame about. That's okay. We heal it all in cash consciousness. But if you don't take radical responsibility for the decisions that you made to where you are with your burn rate month to month, you will never be able to make the adjustments you need to live a really, truly wealthy life. Now that I'm off my soapbox, let's talk about another show. Let's talk about Summer House. I'm not really a huge Summer House girly. I'm not really into the show. I don't know if it's because I didn't watch it from the beginning, but I don't really care about any of the characters. Anybody feel me on that? Maybe you have a show that everybody's crazy about, but you just couldn't give a shit. Well, Summer House is kind of that show for me. However, I'll still have it on in the background. Like, it's fine, whatever. I'm just not super invested. But I was super invested when there was a little bit of drama that happened, and it's about to play out on this season of Summer House between Craig and Kyle. And you're saying, Amber, hold on, Craig's not even on Summer House. I know, but he's dating Paige, who's on Summer House, so he kind of like triangulates into the show. Here's what happened. So just to paint the picture, Kyle owns a canned cocktail drink called Loverboy. Craig Conover, it was announced during while they were filming this, that he had become an investor in Spritz Society, which is a sparkling wine canned cocktail. It just so happens to be owned by the Oshry sisters, Claudia and Jackie, who host The Toast. So he comes out with his own flavor. It's like a lemon iced tea flavor, and he starts to promote it. And it's honestly, to Kyle, like a big fuck you, because Kyle has been trying to get this drink off the ground, Loverboy, and he feels slighted that Paige's boyfriend didn't support him, but instead supported some other girls. He's like, who are these people? And what was really interesting about this all is Craig's side versus Kyle's side. And Craig said, hey, I just tried Spritz first and I liked it better and I did a deal with them. And Kyle's like, hey, you should have loyalty to me. Why are you promoting somebody else's brand? So he very stupidly goes on Watch What Happens Live or something else, and he starts to talk poorly about this competitor brand. And there is nothing that you can do to lose my respect more quickly than to talk publicly about a competitor in business to you. And that's just so dumb. Like, just don't say anything. It is so much more powerful to have nothing to say and let it all play out. The other thing that I just want to say is that the Loverboy product is so freaking expensive. Their espresso martini cocktail is $40 for 8 cans. You guys, that's crazy. Just make your own espresso martini at home. Why would I want that in a can? So anyway, Kyle goes on TV and he talks a bunch of shit. And he says all this stuff about the company Spritz, and he talks badly about Craig. But let's go to the lesson that we're talking about here. The thing that we're talking about in this segment of the show is investor types. And Craig comes back and goes, yo, I know I have a lot of draw. I have a social media audience. I'm on 2 shows. If I'm going to be involved in promoting a company, I better damn well be a part owner of it. And Craig said that he had gone to Kyle and asked to be an investor, and Kyle said no. Make it make sense, Kyle. Why are you mad at Craig for wanting to absolutely get paid for the effort of him promoting a brand? He should 1000% be an investor and get a part of the proceeds instead of one of your shitty affiliate deals. Like, he knows that he has social capital. So if he's going to put some energy behind something, he wants to be part owner. It's such a no-duh situation to me. And Kyle is so short-sighted, because the thing that Spritz is doing so well is they're truly like crowdfunding their investment pool with friends and family, which we'll talk about in a second, that all have greener money. They all have social capital. Greener money essentially means that when you give somebody money for an investment, you're not just giving them money, but you're giving them something else that's an intangible value that contributes to the value of you being involved in the project. That could be your social capital. You have a huge social network. It could be your experience in a vertical or an industry or your connections. It could be the fact that you're on 2 TV shows and you have the opportunity to promote the product to 2 different audiences. That's greener money. So when we talk about investors, I'm sure you've heard a lot of these terms before, but I think it's really important to break down the different types of investors. You've heard VC, angel investor, all these types of things. Let's talk through some of the different types of investors that exist. The first type of investor, and if you are interested in starting a business that's going to hockey stick with great returns, and what I mean by hockey stick is that it's going to, in a very short amount of time, shoot up in revenue very, very quickly because you're so smart and you're going to make it pop off, you might solicit for your first round of investment to friends and family. Friends and family is an investment type. They invest the most money in startups in aggregate, investing over $60 billion per year. In fact, 38% of startup founders report raising money from their friends and family first, and the average amount invested is $23,000. This is a really good way to raise seed money to get your company off the ground. So many companies do this. In fact, I've talked about this before, but you know that Jeff Bezos, his mother, I think, invested $150,000. I might be saying the wrong amount, but she gave him the seed funding for Amazon to get started. And so many people out there have these stupid memes that are like, oh, you think Jeff Bezos is so good? Well, he's just another Nepo baby with a rich mommy. Okay. If I gave you $150,000 tomorrow, would you turn it into as much money as Jeff Bezos had? Would you change our entire society's expectations of shipping times? Do you have a good enough idea and enough tenacity to do what Jeff Bezos did with $150,000? I don't think so. I don't think a lot of us do. I think he's actually pretty special. So let's stop talking shit on Jeff Bezos of getting his money from his mother, because it is so common. Friends and family is one of the most common ways for startup founders to get their company off the ground. These close circles usually consist of individuals who are likely to feel a strong effect from your brand, who are going to be impacted, who know your work ethic, who know what you're capable of. It is such a common way to get started. However, I caution you, do not take or give money in a friends and family round unless there is an ironclad cap table that has your investment listed out. You have a legal document, you have partnership agreements, you have all of the agreements all signed. My gosh, do not go into any investment without doing your due diligence. And if you are looking or being asked to invest in somebody's new startup. This is not financial advice, but I would basically tell you to pretend like that money has gone away. Investing in any company is incredibly risky. And even venture capitalists, which we'll get to in a moment, even they don't bank on every single investment that they make popping off. They're looking for 1 out of 100 companies to do well. They expect 99% of what they invest in to absolutely shit the bed and fail. And there's usually one unicorn company that saves the rest of the fund from absolute disaster. So you can invest in 100 companies, but if you invested in Uber in the first round, you're golden. You can invest in 100 companies, 99 of them you've never heard of again, but Airbnb was in that round, you're good, right? So let's talk about the next category of investors. These are angel investors. This is different than a venture capitalist because an angel investor is a high net worth individual who invests directly into a startup, into a company, into a business, whatever. They're typically successful entrepreneurs themselves. They might have been corporate leaders. They might have sold their other companies. That's how they got the money to invest in other companies. And they can be a good fit for startups if there's synergy or personal alignment or interest in the growth of the business. And like I said, that greener money. Like if you have done this before, you know the perils, the pitfalls, the things to watch out for. Or maybe you invest in somebody as an angel investor and you can introduce that entrepreneur to licensing deals or operations or manufacturing people, all these different types of greener money scenarios. That's when an angel investor makes a lot of sense. And there are an estimated about 250,000 angel investors in the United States, and they invest about $20 billion into approximately 60,000 companies a year. Now, just a reminder, friends and family invest $60 billion per year, angel investors $20 billion per year, and angel investors are investing about 75 grand into companies at a time, where the average amount for friends and family is about 25. Okay, the next category of investors is venture capital. Venture capital is run like a business, right? So imagine an office where there's people there that manage money. They have often collected money from other investors to pool a fund of money together, POOL, pool a fund of money together. And let's say they have a pool of $100,000. Then the people that run this venture capital firm are meant to be stewards of that money and invest it in opportunities. So all of these deals or decks come across their desk and they have to evaluate all of these different companies and entrepreneurs and find a deal to put the money into where they think they're going to have a successful run. VCs look at so many decks. That's why they say don't make your deck longer than 10 pages. If you're looking for money, you've got to focus on the metrics. You've got to be really compelling and have a great sales pitch. Because on average, VCs only invest in 1 out of every 100 deals they consider. So angels will typically act as mentors to the entrepreneurs that they bankroll, right? But venture capital is a consistently active form of financing where they are involved. And I'm not talking about like in the day-to-day operations, but they're there to very heavily influence, add value, to be involved in important decisions and make sure that that company goes on the right path because they're stewards of other people's money, right? They're maybe stewards of their own money, of course, too. There's a lot of VC firms that were founded by people that had huge exits from companies. They get more capital and then they manage that capital by investing in deals, and they also have to make sure their investments stay healthy. So they're involved in management of those entrepreneurs or startups. If you need some more on this, the show on HBO called Silicon Valley is so worth your time. It is so funny and it really does show you truthfully what it's like out there. And it is that crazy. I have worked with a lot of investment partners in my life, and it can get a little wacky out there. So really interesting to see this all play out on reality TV with Craig and with Kyle. Now, Craig is not a venture capitalist. Craig is not an angel investor, but he's definitely a friends and family investor who has greener money. And he made the right decision for him by going to invest in Sprit Society, where he could invest versus just getting an affiliate payout to build the brand equity for Kyle. Now, when you invest in a company, you invest to get a percentage of the company, which is called equity. That equity might be granted to you in the form of shares or in percentage ownership, but essentially what's happening when you invest in a company, whether you invest your time, your resources, or your cash, your cold hard cash, you expect to get a percentage of the profits from the company, as well as the profits from any equity event that would happen for the company. For example, if you are going to sell the company at some stage in the future and you are part owner of it, you would expect to be paid out. I just talked about Alani Nu selling for $1.8 billion on the last episode. They had a lot of early stage investors. They had a lot of partners. They had a lot of people that were involved in the company, and they all got paid when that sale happened. So when you're an investor, you have a vested interest as an owner to make sure that the company does well, and you're going to do everything in your power to help that company be successful so that you can be successful when it sells. Now, let's get into my next favorite topic and my favorite, the thing that started it all, which was this idea of understanding index funds. Now, if you've heard me talk about the Jack Bogle method of investing, I'm a Bogle head. Jack Bogle, B-O-G-E-L, and actually, I don't even know if I'm saying that right. I'm just reading it, so if I'm saying it wrong, can somebody correct me? But he was the founder of Vanguard, and Vanguard is known for their very low-cost index funds. I've talked about index funds before. I love an index fund, and by the way, this is not investment advice, but I am going to give you a really brilliant analogy to understand it. Are you ready? So if you're a fan of Bravo, and let's say each of the shows on Bravo are their own company, you have the Vanderpump Rules show, you have the Real Girlfriends of Paris show, you have NYC Prep, you have Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, you have Real Housewives of Dallas. These are all different companies. And let's say you had the opportunity to invest in one of these companies. You could buy a share of Real Housewives of Potomac. You could buy a share of Real Housewives of Atlanta. You could buy a share of Winter House, whatever it was. If you bought a share and then based on how well that show performed, whether it's through, I don't know, pick a metric, popularity or ad revenue, something measurable, and you say, you know what, I think Winter House is really going to pop off because Malia from Below Deck is going to be on it, and I just know that's going to be so good. So I'm going to buy shares in Winter House because I believe that show will perform. And then that show that you invest in shits the bed and nobody watches it or talks about it ever. Nothing happens on the show. It's not compelling. Nobody wants it. It doesn't go anywhere. And so the value of that show, whether through popularity or ad revenue or whatever metric it is you've decided to measure it on, doesn't grow your money. You were hoping that it was going to grow when you bought into the show, but nobody really watched it. Or here's another example. Maybe you were an early stage Vanderpump Rules fan and you loved the Stassi era. I'm not sure what I did to you, but I'll take a Pinot Grigio. Or when she backhanded Kristen, like you were like, this is it. This is the show that's forever. This is a safe bet. I know the show will always grow. It'll always be so good. Like, I've got this. And then we get some amazing seasons with Sheena Shea falling in love with Rob and he can hang a television in 7 minutes. And then she breaks up with him and then something else happens that I don't even remember. I can't even think right now, but all these things happen. And then all of a sudden, scandal, and Jax and Stassi and Kristen, they all get fired from the show. And then we had that really tragic season with Max and Dana. Do you remember that? And Charlie, I don't even know what that was. It was a big old mess. And your stock went into the toilet. And we have a couple really bad seasons after that. Like season 9, we had what? Like Sheena and Brock got engaged. Lala had a baby. Nobody cares. They're trying to open Schwartz and Sandy's. And you're like, man, this show really shit the bed. I'm just going to sell all my stock. And so at the end of season 9, you sell it all. You made a little bit of money, but the show really didn't perform that well. And you sell it when it's really down. It's nowhere near the peak of popularity, right? And then you sell it right before Scandoval breaks. And then the show is national news. You've never had a more popular show on Bravo. It's talked about everywhere. And the popularity goes through the freaking roof. And you're like, oh my God, I missed this rocket ship. Because timing of reality TV shows and timing of companies is impossible. It is impossible to know when things are going to pop off. You cannot time the market. Predicting what will happen in a company or a TV show is nearly impossible. And when you invest in just one thing at a time, it puts a lot of pressure on that one thing to perform for you so that you make some profit in your money. And the thing about it is, The Boglehead method of investing is don't buy the needle, buy the haystack. And what that means is, in his mind, in his own words, is to invest in index funds. An index fund is a type of investment that tracks a market index like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100, and they're designed to match the performance of the index. So you can buy a share of the S&P 500 by buying an index fund like VOO or VTI, and it's just going to track what happens in the blend of 500 companies versus just buying Meta stock or just buying Tesla stock or just buying Apple stock. And I look at Bravo like an index fund because if you think about it, the index fund of Bravo is all of the shows combined. So while there's really bad seasons of Vanderpump Rules, there's really great seasons of Southern Charm or even better seasons of Real Housewives of Orange County or Beverly Hills or whatever else is happening. What you're investing in and the mindset is totally different. You're not looking for one show to invest in. You're not looking for one company to invest in. You're looking for consumer trends. You're looking for things that are happening on a larger scale. I happen to believe that more and more people will get exposed to reality television. I believe the production quality, the storytelling gets better and better all the time. I believe that Bravo will continue to grow over time. I believe that if I were to invest in something, I would want to invest in Bravo as a whole because I know that the popularity of all of these shows continues to grow and grow and grow, where sometimes they're really going to suck and have a shitty season because we've all lived through a shitty season of reality TV. But we know that there's another show that's going to pop up, a new thing that's going to come along. They're always adjusting what's on our television automatically by watching ratings, taking things off, putting things on, trying new things. Like maybe Real Housewives of Dubai got canceled because nobody was watching it, but Real Housewives of Miami is a total hit. And they brought it back into the rotation. And that's exactly what an index fund does. The S&P 500 is the top 500 companies in the United States. When a company becomes 501th, the 501st, I guess is how you'd say that, 501th, oh my God, Amber, 501st company, and there used to be 499, they're out of the S&P 500, and another more successful company takes their place. It automatically rebalances. So when you invest in something like the S&P 500, you're banking on, is America going to be, to continue to be a good place to do business? Is America going to be a place where companies stay? Is America going to be a place that I think will grow over time? If you believe those things, then you could consider investing in an index fund that automatically adjusts over time, depending on what's happening in the individual companies, but you don't have to monitor the individual companies. You know that the powers that be will automatically take care of that adjustment for you so that you don't have to worry about it. Okay, let's go to the next section, which is about copyrights. Now, I talked a little bit about copyrights with Something About Her. I just want to underline this is not legal advice, but I want to talk about copyrights as it relates to cheater brands. If you remember, we've talked about Bethany Frankel and Skinny Girl Margarita, and Sonia Morgan was trying to come out with a Tipsy Girl restaurant. This was way back in the day. This was the heyday of Real Housewives of New York City. And Sonia, in all of her glory, was so proud to be announcing this new restaurant venture called Tipsy Girl. And being that she was on the same show with Bethany, the founder of Skinny Girl, an alcoholic product that, when consumed, might make you a tipsy girl, there's a lot of confusion in that. And that's what's called a cheater brand. Bethany was right with that. It's cheating or riding the coattails of another brand's popularity to actually try to cause confusion in the marketplace so people don't really know who owns it, what it means, or whose it is. Because it might make sense for somebody like Bethany to go start a restaurant called Tipsy Girl where they served Skinny Girl, right? So what I wanted to highlight with copyright is that there's a lot of noise that happens on social media anytime somebody starts a new business venture, and I'm talking about celebrities. This just recently happened with Meghan Markle, for example. She started this jam company. It was called American Riviera Orchard. Terrible name, by the way. Terrible name. And then she came out and she did this very bizarre, very oddly chopped up Instagram video where she announced that she wasn't going to use that because the name American Riviera Orchard indicated that all of her products would have had to come from the Santa Barbara, Montecito area, and she didn't want to do that, so she was going to change the name of her jam brand to As Ever. So now we have As Ever Jam. Is that even the name? I'm kind of blanking on it now. I don't have notes. I'm just riffing on this. But as is wont to happen in this very competitive online space, a brand called As Ever NYC started posting saying, "Megan stole my name and we want to be compensated and support small businesses and yada, yada, yada." And here's the thing. As Ever Jam by Meghan Markle cannot be confused with As Ever Clothing because they're in two separate categories. This is what people don't understand about copyright, is that when you file a trademark, and copyright, by the way, has to do with like written work, like a song or a book or whatever. A trademark is what we're talking about here. Actually, I should have corrected that. But when you file for a trademark, you are filing for a trademark in a specific category. Those categories are defined by the USPTO, which is the United States Post Office. No, I'm just kidding. United States Official, I don't know, Trademark Patent Office or something like that. USPTO, United States Patent Trademark Office, I think is what it is. Don't yell at me. Anyway, they have all these different categories. And then you get to pick, as the person filing for the trademark, what categories you want to file in. So when As Ever NYC was filing for a trademark, it's probably unlikely that they filed for trademark protection in the category of jam. Okay, there's not a category named jam, but there's probably a category for food, food products, housewares, etc. So did Meghan Markle actually steal their trademark? No. There's no original ideas these days. Everybody is doing something that's similar to somebody else's something. And was it intentional? Very likely no. But As Ever claiming that she's infringing on their trademark is absolutely not true. And it's actually such a freaking opportunity for them. They now have global recognition on a brand name that they should be capitalizing on. So what I would want them to do as like, and if I was an investor, so to speak, I'd be like, hey, As Ever just got announced by Meghan Markle. Let's run a fuck ton of ads so that As Ever shows up in all of these different articles and, in Google search and Google search ads and paid ads. Let's blow up your website. Let's capitalize on this opportunity. Let's do some paid PR. Let's do some earned PR. Let's go out there and tell the story. Let's look for opportunity. That's what I would do. So for them to be really sad that somebody else has their name, I get it. But is it causing confusion in the marketplace? No, these are two very different products, two very different brands. So it's not causing confusion in the marketplace, which is one of the tests, as well as who was first to market with the usage in the category. Whereas where we have Tipsy Girl and Skinny Girl, it's a little bit too confusing from the same show within the same realm of possibility in the same city. I don't know. It's a whole nother conversation. My point is this. Congratulations to the team of As Ever NYC. I hope you guys really are able to capitalize on all of this publicity. And for all of us as consumers of news out there, let's remember to be critical consumers of media and things that are posted on the internet, and take a beat before reacting and going to attack Meghan Markle for doing something she didn't do. Okay, the last topic that I want to talk about here is probably the most common issue we see on Housewives, on these reality TV shows, and it has to do with lifestyle inflation. Because once we see these people start to pop off, we start to see them upgrade their wardrobes, get better hair extensions, drive nicer cars, right? But the topic that I want to talk about today is affordable versus affordability. This is so, so important, especially for us consumers out there when we are talking to different people who are helping us make huge money decisions. I want to talk about this as it relates to housing, because if you are going right now and trying to get pre-approved for a loan to buy a home, you are going to give them your tax returns or your W-2 or your P&L or whatever it is that you have to show your income. And they're going to tell you how much house you can afford. So let's say you take your bank statements in and they're like, congratulations, you've been pre-approved for a home of up to $2.5 million. And you're like, holy shit, this is amazing. Let's go buy a house. I can afford a $2.5 million house. You cannot afford a $2.5 million house. Well, you may be able to, but more than likely you can't. Because what a loan officer is looking at is a financial formula that tells you how much the bank is willing to loan you based on your financial situation. But what it's not considering is the affordability, which focuses on a person's ability to pay for it. So let's say, for example, you get pre-approved for a $2.5 million home. In today's interest rate environment, that's a $15,000 a month mortgage payment, including interest and taxes. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. And that might not be affordable for you, right? Affordable versus affordability, it's a nuance, right? But affordable focuses on the price of an item in relation to other things, where affordability focuses on your ability to pay for it. So affordable, is $15,000 a month on a mortgage payment when you're only making $500,000 a year affordable? No, it is not. The affordability for you as a $500,000 a year earner is low because it doesn't account for all of the other hidden expenses and hidden fees and homeownership and interest and payments and getting fire insurance and all of the things. And the way that this gets construed is that we are often looking outside of ourselves. We are looking to these smarter people, right? I'm using quotes right now. They are not smarter than you. They are good at what they do in writing loans, underwriting loans, giving you the financial formulas, but they do not know what is affordable for you. Affordable is an adjective. Affordability is a concept related to your financial situation. Only you know your financial situation. Only you know how much all your other bills are. Only you know how much it costs for you to put your kids in private school or nanny or daycare or your health insurance or your car payments or all the things. Somebody looking at your W-2 statements does not understand your financial situation. They do not understand your expenditures per month. They are going based off of what you earned and what you tell them, but they cannot determine for you what is affordable. And like we've seen time and time again on all of these shows, so many people overbuy a house and then can't keep up with the payments because it's not actually affordable for them. However, they did get approved for that loan. So at one point, somebody said, you can afford that. But over time, it's shown that it's the affordability that's an issue. Are you following? Robin Dixon from Real Housewives of Potomac, she faced foreclosure and struggled financially after her partner's NBA career was over. They didn't have the same income they were banking on having, and then they couldn't afford their house. Kim Zolciak and Croy Bierman, what a freaking mess. They just sold their Georgia mansion after calling the cops on each other 100,000 times. Those poor freaking kids in that house, like what a disaster. They sold their house for $2.75 million this year in January, but they had originally listed the home for $6 million in October of 2023, but they could not sell it. They defaulted on a loan. They were in foreclosure. The house went to auction at one point. It was a big old mess. And it also was showing on records that they owed over $1 million in unpaid taxes, and they defaulted on their $300,000 home loan. So they had major affordability issues. They also had, according to gossip, this is all alleged, some gambling issues, Kim. So that's interesting. Teresa and Joe Giudice in New Jersey, their mansion was almost auctioned off after their fraud conviction. They filed for bankruptcy. They claimed $11 million in debt. I mean, they faced some pretty serious legal challenges and legal bills. I'm not surprised that they had a hard time paying for their home and they got to the point of foreclosure because you know they spent a ton of money defending themselves and trying to not go to jail and not get deported. And here we are. Speaking of, did you guys see this news about Karen Huger from Real Housewives of Potomac going to jail for, I think, a year or maybe 2 years for her DUIs? I mean, I'm not saying that she shouldn't be punished for recklessly driving drunk and being caught 4 times. Like, get her off the road, take away her license, never let her drive again. That is so disgustingly irresponsible. But she was in a bunch of drama with Giselle, do you remember? Of like Uncle Sam, taxes, all that kind of stuff. I don't even know. This is going to be crazy to see how it plays out. Anyway, Tamara Judge from Real Housewives of Orange County. She sold her home in a short sale after having financial difficulties because of their divorce. I mean, there are so many people out there that have been affected by this conversation about affordable versus affordability. If you go get approved for a home, that does not mean it's affordable for you. So that's my word of warning today. You guys, there is so much drama that happens on Real Housewives on all these Bravo shows. For my Bravo fans out there, I so hope you enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed researching it so, so much. I love talking about Real Housewives, but to everybody else, I promise I'm going to lay off for a while. Like maybe this is the last time I do it this year. I just had to dive in. We just have to make money more fun. We just have to have some fun with it. So I hope you had fun on this episode. I love you guys so, so much, and I'll talk to you on the next one. Bye. Feeling rich? I hope so. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Old Money. If you have questions you want answered, email me at oldmoneypodcast@gmail.com or hit us up on social. We are at Old Money Podcast, and I am at your service. If this episode spoke to you, inspired you, helped you, if you took a single note, it would mean the world to me if you could please just take a minute to rate and review the podcast. And if you're not doing so already, subscribe. And if you have friends who like getting rich, please share this episode with them, even if it's just on your Instagram story. And I'd love you more than Jeff Bezos loves Amazon Prime. Thank you so much, and I will talk to you on the next episode. Remember, I'm not your lawyer, I'm not your tax professional, and I'm not your financial advisor. The content presented in this podcast is intended to entertain, educate, inspire, and support listeners in their personal and professional development and does not constitute business, financial, or legal advice. In addition to that, this episode may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products and services.